Anyone have anything on their mind?
Oh, look at this. A lot of people have things on their mind. Let's start with Jordan.
Okay, so after that guided meditation, the whole witness thing, I still find myself feeling closer to it and then feeling further from it. And so I'm just going to dump a bunch of things that arose, and I'd love you to untangle them as you will. But there's definitely an element of my mind searching for something that it can grasp, which definitely seems like the way that I'm not going to find the witness. But you know, looking for some feeling, looking for some idea, and constantly being like, no, not that, no, not that, not that. And there's a feeling of chasing its own tail, you know? And that idea of how can the eyeball see itself, and how to get into that witness. And it does seem like an element of stopping, you know, and stopping the trying, and stopping the seeking, and just being what is, which is that awareness, which is holding all of this stuff. But feeling what it is to be that, when the feeling is just a construct of the mind.
Yeah.
How to... That's all I got.
Is there a question in that?
Yeah, like, how do you do that? what's the approach here? And how do you...
I don't know what inspired me to guide you in that today, but this is something that... It takes time. It takes time of trying to discover that, and sometimes thinking you have, and then realizing that you may have been really close, but no, not yet. So just keep trying. Just keep until you don't try anymore. So, one little clue though. If you keep this in mind when you find yourself trying, is the, let's speak of it in terms of consciousness, that consciousness is there even in deep sleep. It's there all the time.
And that was something that struck me during the guided meditation. Of just like when looking for it, the awareness, and there's something that you said, that whatever has been there bearing witness to this all along is that.
Yes.
And so there's a sense of its presence,
yeah,
without being able to, like, you know, touch it in a way.
Yeah.
Like, grab it.
Yeah. You can't see it. You can be it,
but
you can't see it. And the only way you be it is by stopping trying to be anything else. I hope the rest of you enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I've been getting lots of encouragement to do more guided meditations.
Yay! Like that.
So I'm getting more encouragement all the time. Tucker?
It's a really hard one, but it segues nicely from that. So, it's the concept of what you think happens to consciousness at death. I told you it was hard. That I'd come to see consciousness as kind of a viewpoint of emptiness, right? That there's not any real, like, solid, unchanging object there in the first place, that it's a continuation of something that's, you know, been changing. But it seems like death of the body isn't just one more change, you know, comparable to all the other ones. And I'm wondering if you or Wisdom have an idea on what happens to the consciousness, or, you know, the stream that has sort of like the characteristics of consciousness.
Are you asking what happens to the stream of consciousness that you experience in your life when you die? The stream of consciousness that is your identity in this life, what happens to it when you die? Is that what you're asking?
Not exactly. It's like there's the language joke is tricky. There's something that is some mechanism or whatever that is doing the perceiving, right? That gets labeled consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it's what happens to that. It just it seems like it wouldn't make sense to stop because there wasn't really a point where it started. But it also doesn't quite make sense to say it just keeps changing in the way that it had been changing during your lifetime, either.
Well, yeah. Language makes it really tricky to talk about these things, but because what is doing the perceiving in your life is what ceases. But the consciousness itself doesn't change. It always has been.
Is what's doing the perceiving the witness?
Well, at one level it is. But that's the thing with doing the witness practice, is you get to a particular place with it and then you realize that there's still further to go. So, what maybe some of you managed to get to tonight, I don't know, but if you practice this way, what you can get to is a place of the witness as what is doing the perceiving. Okay? But that isn't the end. Okay? There's another step beyond that.
Because Shelley and I were talking about this in the break,
mm-hmm.
Is that witness consciousness? So perhaps there's the first step is for the witness, and then beyond that is like a universal consciousness?
That would be a way of thinking of it. And that could be an extremely accurate way of thinking of it, but you could use exactly those same words and have a wrong view as well.
How so?
Well, because universal consciousness, if you're going to use that term, universal consciousness is truly universal. It is, there's nothing that's not it. Okay? But there's a, just the way our minds work, if you start using the term universal consciousness, you're going to conceive it as something out there. And it may be immensely huge, but it stopped being universal consciousness.
So.
But on the other hand, if you understand that it's everything, then universal consciousness, that is a very good term to use to describe it. Okay? I know that's, they get in these mystical sounding kind of ways of explaining things. Unfortunately, you have to shed some of your normal ways of thinking of things, because until you get past them, you're always going to tend one way or another to misunderstand things. And this happens, and I'll warn you, this happens, you'll have an experience in meditation, or it could be otherwise too, but you'll have an experience that gives you just a really profound insight into things. And then after your words, your mind will start chewing on it, conceptualizing it, and pretty soon you won't be able to get in touch with that, with what you learned in that experience anymore, because your mind has created this concoction that's sitting there in front of it. So you have to go back and have the experience again. And what that allows you to do is to recognize that your mind's concoction is a concoction until eventually it becomes transparent. Your mind will always make concoctions, but after a while, they're transparent concoctions.
So it's like, would it make sense to rephrase your answer saying like that the perceiving is kind of based on sight, the senses. So the eyes, when the body dies, the eyes will decay, and the optical cortex decays,
yeah.
and that kind of stuff. But that the actual kind of consciousness. Life force, whatever it was. So the eyes, for instance, take in the sensory data, but there's some entity that perceives that sensory data, and that this is sort of an emanation of the universal consciousness, such that it doesn't change as the molecules of the universe move around.
You could say that, but it's a potentially problematic
as a long also.
Yeah. All of the kind of linear thinking and time-based thinking that you bring to questions like this are going to inevitably mislead you.
So as you know, I've been doing this who am I meditation, and progressively I found that more and more that sort of witness aspect of it becomes more and more transparently a construct, and then you create a third witness who watches the witness one, and then that falls apart. And so I guess I was wondering about a systematic way to proceed after that point. What I did is I reformulated the question from who am I to, okay, this is something, it's not self, it's the brain's, it's the action of the brain that makes, you know, the feeling of personality with self. And so I was able to, like, yeah, there was that sense of transparency that you just talked about. But is there a systematic way of cultivating that sort of dispassionate attitude that's like a step past the witness?
It's the same process, but you can change the words that you use when thinking about it, which will help. If at this point you can get rid of thinking in terms of I, who am I? Right? Forget who am I. It's more like what is this, or what's happening, or just. More like what's happening. But the process is the same. The process is you just keep looking and it becomes more and more transparent. You know, to the point where all those goofy Zen stories make sense. What is just is, and it's that, you know, anybody can start from where you are right now without any practice at all and very quickly realize that the consciousness is the essence of everything, that your conscious experience is, you know, it's all there is. Everything else is inference. Everything else is imagination, projection, conjecture. All there is your conscious experience. Take that away and there's nothing. So you know that the only place that you can look, you have to start looking into this, because, you know, like I say, you don't have to do any practice at all. Just think about it a little bit, rationally, intellectually, you'll realize that anywhere else you look is obviously a waste of time. Because everything, existence itself, is reducible to consciousness, logically. So therefore, that's where you want to look. And anytime you find yourself looking somewhere else, you remember this, and you can decide whether or not you want to keep wasting your time in that direction.
What are some of the examples of the else?
What's that?
What are some of the examples of the else, of the other places to look?
Well, there's all kinds. I mean, trying to understand the world in terms of a material universe out there is a something else. Or trying to understand things in terms of a mind that's creating all this stuff, that's a something else. Those are kind of the two big ones. But there's all kinds of variations on those. But forget matter, forget mind. Because mind doesn't matter. That's your matter, never mind. Just get right down to it. It's conscious experience in the present moment is the only place to look. And there's a lot of different ways to approach that. But that's where you've ultimately got to look. Right now, in the present moment, the unfolding of conscious experience, understand the nature of the unfolding of conscious experience. See it as in its subject-object duality. See it in all these other ways that it presents itself. That's what you need to be looking at. Not that studying the material universe and the mind and all these other things isn't wonderful, because it is. But, you know, if you want to really get to the nut of it, it's obvious where you have to go. Everything else is just, well, it all revolves around that. You know, in one way or the other, you all think you are your mind. You know what I'm saying? One way or another, you all think you are your mind. And of course, when you think about death, that's really disturbing. It's just, I am my mind, my mind's going to stop when my brain turns into this soup of decay. What happens to the mind?
Is death not disturbing to you?
Hmm?
Is death not disturbing to you?
To me personally, no. But I'm sure it is to a lot of you. And, you know, that's really, that is a big part of what this is all about. Right? You know, I'm tempted to try to engage once again in a systematic presentation of what the Buddha Dharma is about. And it all begins, I'm going to maybe get to the point where I ask these questions, everybody in the room immediately says the answer. What did the Buddha teach?
Suffering and the end of
suffering. Very good. Suffering and the end of suffering. And of course, fear of death is a big part of that. So that is what we've been talking about. To understand suffering, and then to move on to understanding the end of suffering. So you have to understand why it is that death causes suffering. Why it is that death, the idea of death, bothers you. And since it's just one more manifestation of the suffering that permeates every aspect of your existence, instead of starting with why we're afraid to die, let's just, you know, you start with what is suffering and why do we suffer? That's the place to start with. And so Buddha taught suffering and the end of suffering in that order. So here's the other one I want to get everybody to be able to give me the answer right back. What did Buddha tell us about suffering?
Physical and mental.
What?
Physical and mental?
Yes, physical and mental. Actually, the answer I'm looking for is pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. Yeah. But to understand that, what's the difference between pain and suffering? So, unpleasantness, which is what dukkha means. Dukkha is unpleasantness, and unpleasantness is There's the unpleasantness that's physical in origin, and there's the unpleasantness that's mental in origin. And so when you say that pain is inevitable, suffering is optional, what that distinction is really important. As the physical creatures we are in the world, unpleasant physical experiences are absolutely unavoidable. If you had ever hoped that you would find a way to avoid that, forget it. But it doesn't matter, because unpleasant experiences are just unpleasant experiences. It's the suffering that's superadded by the mind that's the problem. And that's completely optional. So there is no way out of the fact that your body's going to get old, decay, and die, or do something else sooner and die. Yeah. And so the problem is that when you think about this, dwell on this, sense that it's impending or whatever, it can cause you to suffer. But you don't have to. It doesn't have to. There's no need for suffering. So yeah, suffering is mental and physical. And mental you can do something about. And when you do something about the mental, the physical doesn't matter anymore. It's pretty much irrelevant.
So isn't suffering just mental?
I would say to use the English word suffering, let's just use suffering to mean mental. Now when you have a pain, you have mental suffering associated with it. Like as in one of the Buddha's teachings, he compared that to being shot with two arrows. Now an unpleasant physical experience is to be shot with one arrow. But to suffer as a result of it is to be shot with a second arrow. And so we're talking about what you can do about the second arrow. So now if we look at the kinds of suffering in a different way of dividing them up, there's what you might call ordinary suffering, which is physical pain and the mental suffering that is associated with it. And then there's the mental suffering that's associated with grief and all kinds of other things that cause mental suffering. Being rejected by your lover, whatever, you know, all the different things that trigger our mind to generate a lot of suffering. That's ordinary suffering. Mostly, what most people think of when they think of suffering is that's what we're referring to in that category, ordinary suffering. The other two kinds of suffering require a little more reflection to understand. The second one is the suffering that comes from impermanence. And that's the suffering that you experience when you get what you want, because some part of your mind knows you're going to lose it. And that is a kind of suffering that is somewhere in the background of our mind all the time, because we know we're going to die. And if you think about it, the suffering that comes from impermanence, It's a suffering that is sort of in the background and colors everything. Every good thing, every bad thing, everything is colored by the suffering that derives from the fact that nothing is permanent. Everything changes. Everything's in flux. And even at a deeper level, it's the suffering that comes from the fact that there really are no things. And because there are no things, every time we cling to something, we create suffering because we're clinging to something that isn't real. You follow me on that one? Yeah. Because the meaning of impermanence isn't that there are things but they don't last. although that's the very, that is the gross level. The true meaning of impermanence is there are no things. There is only flux. There is only change. And everything is just something that the mind has projected. It's isolated a piece out of the flux and pretends it's not really just flux and thinks it's a thing. And as soon as you cling to something that isn't real, there is an element of suffering that's associated with that. So, and then the third kind of suffering is the called existential suffering, the suffering that comes because of the human condition. You know, the suffering that comes, part of that is the suffering that we know that we're going to die. You know, I watch the deer and the birds, and, you know, they're not troubled by that. They live, something happens, they die. If a mate or a member of the deer's herd or something dies, the other deer experience some loss and something is missing. But their minds aren't, they don't know that they're going to die in the way that we know. I'm sure there's some kind of knowing that they have. But the human condition brings with it its own unique kind of suffering. One of the forms it takes is we desperately want meaning. The more aware we are of how life is suffering, the more we want that suffering to, we want life to mean something, so that suffering has some meaning, some purpose, that it's not just pointless, blind, meaningless suffering. You know what I'm saying? And that existential suffering permeates so much. You know, we put all our efforts into these wonderful things that we think we're doing or we want to do, and then some part of us just knows that, you know, it's just a story we're making up. We love our children, and some part of us knows, yeah, and they're going to get old and have a lot of problems, and then they're going to die. And it's not going to be any different than it is for me or for my parents. It's the same for everybody. And what's the point? Why is this happening? And when you become aware of that existential kind of suffering, a lot of times it gives you this urge to, oh, I just want to get it over with. Let's just, you know, stop. Anybody ever had that feeling? I should say, anybody ever hasn't had that feeling? So those are the three kinds of suffering. And the only one of them, in the ordinary suffering, is the only one of them that includes the physical unpleasantness as a component. And it's the only one that includes something that can't be transcended.
Sorry, it can't be what?
What's that?
I'm sorry, you said it can't be what?
Transcended.
Transcended.
Transcended. Overcome. You know, and you don't need to suffer anymore. That's ultimately the possibility. And of course, even if you don't get to the place of completely overcoming every kind of suffering for all time, if you embark on this path, you're going to experience less suffering. But right from the very beginning, it is going to. As soon as you gain some understanding, the least bit of understanding, it's going to diminish the amount of suffering that you're subject to.
So what is it that gets reincarnated?
The word reincarnation, incarnation is to come into a body, and re is to come into a body again. And as long as matter organizes itself into sentient beings, consciousness will be reincarnated. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. It's just not me.
But if you're thinking, yeah, am I going to be reincarnated? No. I mean, you, the you, the self that you think you are, is definitely not going to be reincarnated. It's an illusion. And the basis of that illusion, you know, the things that an illusion is built out of, are things that are causally determined, arising and passing away due to causes. They're material things and they're mental things, and they're in a constant state of flux. And that is what your mind uses to generate the idea of me. So even the basis of it contains no self in it. It's just process. And so, no, that the idea of self that your mind generates now, and all the different variations on it that somehow imagine that they're the same thing, those are not going to be reincarnated. There is a sense in which they will forever exist, but they're not. But what you think of as you is not going to get born into a new body.
I had the thought some time ago that I can see pictures of myself as a 6-year-old or 7-year-old or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I looked at those pictures and said, yeah, that person doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
In some ways it does. You know,
there is a causal relationship between that person and this person. Yeah, that's true. There is a chain of causality, an extremely complex chain of causality, that you could follow back. But the other thing is that the 7-year-old you is not the cause of the present you. It's the 7-year-old you and all of the different versions of you in every instant between them, combined with essentially the whole universe in every one of those instants that has created you. So, I mean, what I'm saying is the me of this moment is a partial cause of me in the next moment, but only a partial cause. It's me in this moment plus the universe in this moment that is the cause of me in the next moment. And if you look at the picture of yourself as a 7-year-old child, and you can remember that stage in your life where you were taking in vast amounts of new information that molded your view of the world and your view of yourself, but it wasn't coming from your own experience. About probably 90% of it or so was coming from other people. So other people were creating you. Your mother, your father, your neighbors, other kids at school, your teachers, everybody was playing a role in creating you. Yeah.
Well, would it be true then that some people stay that way, stay 7 years old in a way, because everything they're taking in is from the outside?
Because everything what?
Everything they're taking in is from the outside. Just information. That's how they create their sense of meaning.
Well, to a certain degree, we all are. I think the reason that if you reflect on when you were a 7-year-old, when you were 7 years old, you hadn't there wasn't a lot of idea of the world and yourself in there yet. It was still pretty limited,
right?
And it was being constructed very rapidly. But still today, yeah, it's all. Everything from the outside is playing a major role in your self-creation process.
True. I guess I'm not being very clear. I'm just thinking of a kind of a way of life where people take lots of courses and gain a lot of information, quote unquote. A course on musicals, a course on, I don't know what, geology. Yeah.
That is one of the ways.
And it's almost a defense against something. I'm a little unclear, but it's a defense against, or perhaps a...
I know what you're saying. One of the ways,
help me out.
One of the ways that some people cope is to very actively go out and try to find other people and courses and whatever to help them create themselves, so they can create themselves in a particular way. And there are some people too, another way that some people cope is that they surround themselves by people who will reflect an image of them that they want back at them. And so this helps them to be somebody. You know, if all of you keep seeing me the way you see me and reflect back what I want, I must be real. That's very comforting. Of course, if some of you start seeing me differently in a way that I don't want, oh, that could be terrible. Yeah, it could really disturb me. I could get upset, feel like I have to do something, stay awake at night. Want to make sure it doesn't spread to the rest of you. Most of all, I don't want to start believing it. That would be terrible.
I was thinking of a little placard I saw in somebody's refrigerator saying, don't try to find yourself, create yourself.
Yes, and that's, you know, that's really good advice. Create yourself. You know, and that's a very important thing to do. When you realize the truth, then it opens up this fabulous possibility that, if I'm already creating myself and I've been doing it mindlessly all the time, I can start doing it on purpose. I can start taking a little responsibility for it. You know, we like to think that there's only one self. We've talked about this before. But when you examine, you realize, and everybody's always agreed when we've had this conversation, that, there's a lot of different versions of me that come out in different times and different circumstances. Not to mention, even the versions are changing from day to day and circumstance to circumstance. But there is something that we value both, there's both a shared value and a personal value, and that is integrity, right? And you can create integrity within your multiple selves. Because one of the things that is a problem for most, if not all people, is that of these multiple selves that they are, that there are conflicts, and there are sides of yourself that come out that you don't like. As a matter of fact, there's probably sides of yourself that don't like the other sides of yourself. And just realizing that there really is this multitude of selves that are the results of causes and conditions, you can start taking some responsibility for shaping them and bringing a certain degree of harmony to them, which will result in integrity. If you think about being the same person all more or less the same, at least at the superficial level, being the same person all of the time, no matter who you're with, no matter where you are and what you're doing, you will never have that experience of having something revealed about yourself to somebody that you would rather not have, right? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because you'd be the same self to every person, at least at a more superficial, to a degree. I mean, there's never going to be one single self that's you. But you can get all these manufactured selves to basically be based on the same theme, same set of principles, same set of values. And when that happens, you don't need to apologize for any of them. Right? And nor do they need to apologize to each other. So that's one of the benefits that comes just from understanding the true nature of your mind and the idea of who you are. It's just one example. All the different ways that imagining ourselves to be one way while we're something else causes us to have problems, difficulties, and suffering in our life. These are all of the kinds of things that can be resolved by understanding the way things really are.
I've had an idea lately that you know when you're meditating and you're getting dull and you go into hypnagogic state?
Yeah.
So I've had this idea that that we're just living like that all the time. And then when we're enlightened, we're coming out of that hypnagogic state.
Brilliant insight. That's exactly true. Yeah. That's exactly true.
Just confirm that.
That's like a weekend, right? It's getting away from
that we're just collapsing all the time into this. Because like when you see yourself getting into that hypnagogic state, you can see every piece coming together and then you're in that.
Yeah, and the hypnagogic images and the dreams that you have when you are asleep, you become aware that it's easy to be aware that they're concoctions of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we hold them in contrast to reality. So you're sitting in meditation and there's the sensations of the breath, but they turn into waves or branches blowing in some kind of hypnagogic imagery. Your mind's holding this contrast that, well, this is real, and these other things are not real. But then when you realize, well, they're all not real. They're all not real. They're all not real in the same fundamental sense, the same fundamental way.
I had that experience on a mushroom trip. I took way more than I was supposed to. And reality just kept like disappearing. It was like constantly waking up out of a dream. And for hours, I was just waiting until I would come back like into reality that wasn't created by my mind. I was like, oh, this won't happen.
But eventually you came back into a more familiar mind-created reality. More comfortable.
Yeah.
And it's such a relief when that happens.
Not if you're stuck out of it for long enough. Like, I just had to give up that desire to get back because time was so distorted that it felt like I must have been months. And I just was so clinging to coming back down and had to give it up and just say, well, there's no coming down. One thing after another.
Yeah, that's very good. And that allowed you... That allowed you to be okay with it, right? Yeah. We describe that as no longer resisting it. Yeah, accepting it.
Yeah.
Ceasing to react to it. And that's the answer to every kind of suffering.
More drugs.
Yeah,
more realization that if you stop struggling against it, that all of your suffering comes from resistance, from struggling against it, from rejecting, from not accepting what is, you know, and that's the best definition of insanity. That's not accepting what is, and it always hurts. Because what is isn't going to change just because you don't want it.
But I find that like it's like a selective process. Some things I just accept, and other ones I struggle against. And so then there's the constant, or that's what causes the suffering for me. Is, I mean, sometimes I can just accept what's going on, and other times the tape keeps playing, and I don't let go. You know, I say, okay, this is not going to end, and then it does.
This is not going to
end, you know, like, but it does.
But
I mean,
it
changes.
Yeah.
Not end.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, if you have a migraine headache, anybody here have that migraine headache? If you have a migraine headache, the worst thought you can have is this isn't going to end. Mm-hmm. And the best thing that you can do about it is replace it with the thought, that's right, it doesn't have to. Have you ever done that when you've had a migraine headache? Just, even for a moment, just accepted it, stop fighting against it. I haven't had a migraine headache in a long time, maybe somewhere between 10 and 15 years. I hadn't had very many. I can remember both of those things very distinctly. The horror of the thought that this is going to keep going on, especially when you know from past experience that it's only just begun, mm-hmm. and that there's at least hours left to go. And the pain generated by that thought, the mental pain, you know, it's terrible, isn't it? And then, on the other hand, if you surrender to it, resign yourself to it, just stop fighting against it, it's not nearly as bad. It's the complete other side of the coin. Yeah.
Does that work with mental suffering too?
It works with every kind of suffering. Every kind of suffering is a result of rejecting what is, struggling against what is. Now, if somebody close to you dies and you experience grief, that's something that your mind is going to go through that process. And so that's a kind of mental suffering. And it feeds on... It's a kind of mental suffering that feeds on your resistance to the truth that this person you loved is gone. You are never going to see them again. And every time that thought comes into your mind that you're never going to see them again, the grief and the pain just comes up because, you know, you can't accept that. But how does grief resolve itself?
Acceptance.
That's right. At some point, you begin more and more to accept, and then the pain goes away, and then the day comes when you've got a smile on your face, you're completely happy, and yeah, I really miss my mother, she's dead, but hey, you know, it's a beautiful day. Every kind of suffering is ultimately rooted in resistance. It's a very interesting thing. If you think about this, you know, the word dukkha that I translated earlier as unpleasantness also could be translated as unsatisfactoriness. So to be unsatisfied or dissatisfied is to be in the place of rejection of what is. So at the deepest level that you will come to, not only does non-acceptance and resistance cause suffering, at some point you realize that they're actually the same thing. They're identical. Mental suffering is the mind's dissatisfaction, the mind's rejection and resistance to something. So, craving is really just a different manifestation or a different way of looking at and describing dukkha. So we say, craving is the cause of dukkha. Craving is wanting something to be different than the way it is. We say, craving is the cause of suffering. But really, the craving itself, at the deepest level, the craving itself is the suffering. And so, to be free from craving is to be free from suffering. This always happens when I decide to try to be systematic. I come to a certain point. I don't know whether I've really accomplished anything or not. Sometimes it just feels better to answer people's questions as they come along. But no, I do. I really want all of you to come to a point where you know, and you could explain to anybody else, what it was that the Buddha taught and what all this stuff means. If you understand these basic things, I think when it gets to the more esoteric things like emptiness and karma and things like that, then it's a lot easier to understand them too, because they all revolve around the same basic things. And this is worth me saying again for another time after I said 1,000 times, that the cause of suffering is craving. Craving is rooted in the belief that you are a separate self, and that when at the deepest level of your being you realize the truth, craving is no longer and suffering is no longer. Anybody have anything to say before we go?
So why bother doing anything?
Why bother doing anything? Because well, what exactly do you mean? Why
try to pursue careers? Why try to have a family?
Typical stuff that people do.
Okay, yeah. Right. Because pain is inevitable, suffering is optional, and we're just here to have fun. That's the reason for doing things. It's a much better reason for doing things. And all the things that anybody could do anyway, have a career, to be successful for the sake of being successful, now that's kind of a dumb thing that you would get over. But to be successful in the terms of the world, because it's part of having fun, your way of having fun. That's why you would come to be successful, have a career, raise your children, do all of these kinds of things. Does that make sense to you?
It's still an illusion, but it's an enjoyable illusion.
Yeah. There's a tendency for us to strive for things because we have some artificial sense of meaning. So you want to be a success or have a career or whatever, you know. Like, young people do this to motivate themselves. I'm going to go to university and become a blah, blah, blah. And they think about, you know, that's going to give my life meaning and purpose. And other people are going to respect and admire me, and I'll be able to afford a big house and a couple of nice cars and stuff. But that's all illusion, and it's all bound to lead to a certain amount of disillusionment and disappointment, as probably most of you have already done exactly what I described, and you know it's true. That it leads to disillusion and disappointment. On the other hand, it's possible to be in a place where this is doing all of these things. The only reason you do them is because this is how you can have fun. Learning things that you don't know, gaining skills that you didn't have, being able to fulfill a function in society. It doesn't have to have some artificial meaning attached to it. It's good for its own sake. Everything has all the meaning, it has all the potential for meaning that you will ever need already. The potential for meaning is already there. The meaning is always going to come from you. It's never going to come from anywhere else. It's not in the things themselves. And so you can do absolutely anything. You can become a Buddha, or rich and famous, or both at once.
But you know, too, Ladasa, I'm sitting here, and we're using things like success and joy and career and home and all that kind of stuff, and dukkha and craving and suffering and everything. And I'm thinking, I wonder what it would be like if we sitting here were in a refugee camp in Africa, with our bellies bloated. And our baby's dying, and flies going in and out of the nose, and all of these things. I mean, they don't know what success means. I mean, I imagine. I mean, a completely different orientation. Maybe no education either. Probably no education. The way we conceptualize it, education and practice it and pursue it. And I don't know. I don't even have a question here. But I'm thinking we're so privileged to even be. thinking about dukkha and suffering in the framework in which we are, if we were to go to this refugee camp in Africa, I wonder how we'd frame it. I wonder how we'd teach it. I wonder.
Well, you teach it in terms of the values that those people are chasing there. Obviously, it wouldn't make much sense to talk to them about going to university and becoming a lawyer.
No. Exactly. Right.
But one of the important things that you realize in making such comparisons is that, yes, we're very, very fortunate, but it doesn't matter how fortunate you are. Your mind can make it into total suffering. And the opposite of that is true, too. That, you know, it doesn't have to be that way.
And even like on a smaller level, when I tell several faculty members in my educational doctoral program that the reason I'm there is because I'm interested in learning, I get a lecture or a terrible look that I shouldn't be saying that out loud. Because it's about what position I'll get and what prestige will happen and how
goodness.
I will, you know, it's about the
So the important thing to remember, it is really important to remember that we are just here to have fun. And of course, whenever we find out we're not, we need to figure out what we're doing wrong. So but it's not something that you necessarily want to tell a lot of other people.
Tell them girls just want to have fun.
Okay, well, I've kept you long enough, so I'll let you go. Thank you.